Well, of course, I want to begin by thanking both the university and the institute for allowing me to participate in this event. You will not be surprised when I tell you that the American picture is one of some exceptionalism, a term associated closely with American law. In many, many ways. Even the term that is the subject of this proceeding is one that we name promiscuously. Promiscuously not in the usual sense of promiscuous, but promiscuously, we actually being sloppy, which is what we are, we speak of provisional measures, we speak of interim measures, we speak of conservatory measures, we speak of preliminary measures, we speak of protective measures, and we have no idea if there's any difference among them. I have learned just now that there is evidently a difference between provisional and protective. I learned something here. But that gives you some idea about the informality with which American law approaches these questions. I recall Alex stating, describing the English system as not categorical, as not having categories, not being systematic. And I think that is a common law characteristic, and it decisively describes the American law of international arbitration, including, of course, our topic. Now, I don't have PowerPoint. That's a sign of my age. I like people to look at me, okay, rather than the screen. I'm very egoistic. So there you have that. But I will use an occasional French word here and there. So I have what you might call three volets to my presentation. And the reason I have three is you will see, is related to the exceptionalism with which American law is associated. Now, the first volet I'd like to mention is one that, of course, has been covered by others, and I won't have that much to say about it for reasons that will become clear, and that would be something that you discussed in great detail under Swiss law, which would be the use of preliminary, provisional, protective, conservatory measures by arbitral tribunals themselves. So let's call them arbitral measures of interim relief. Then I think much more interesting, with questions that abound still, would be what also Gilles just discussed, which is the role of national courts in furnishing this form of relief in the context of an ongoing arbitration. And the third, which I didn't hear as much of today, but we talk a lot about in the United States, is not strictly the arbitral scene, not strictly the judicial scene, but the role of courts in the enforcement of arbitral measures, what you call execution. But we would continue to call enforcement in American English. Let me start, you caught that, American English. So let me start with the issuance of the measures I've described by arbitral tribunals. Now, we heard a great deal about what Swiss law has to say about that, and that's because you have a respectable Swiss law of arbitration, which is something we don't have. Anybody in this room who knows anything about international arbitration in the United States knows that our arbitration law has the distinction of being virtually unchanged and nearly 100 years old. Dates to 1925. It has not been amended in all of those years except to implement the New York and Panama Conventions. Otherwise, it reads as it did in 1925. Considering the evolution of this field and the burgeoning of issues in this field, that is a remarkable accomplishment, don't you think? That is a remarkable accomplishment on the part of our Congress. Of course, we expect very little of our Congress these days, and this is no exception. So the lex arbitri, such as it is useless on this subject. And I need in parentheses to tell you why, of course, it is so useless. It's not only its age, but its history, its reason, its raison d'etre, was not to regulate arbitration at all. Its raison d'etre was to overcome judicial hostility to arbitration and ensure that arbitration agreements are enforced. And that's all it wanted to do. So it leaves arbitration essentially unregulated, which distinguishes it from the arbitration laws of most of the countries that are probably known to you all. Now, I have to add, though, that as an anomaly, additional anomaly of American law, our states can have international arbitration statutes. And a significant minority of American states have adopted the UNCITRAL model law. So we do have the UNCITRAL model law, Article 17A through J. I don't even remember how far it goes. Article 17A through J is in force in all of the American states that have adopted the UNCITRAL model law. But if we stick to the federal level, we know then that the law doesn't inform us or guide us at all in this domain. And what that means in reality is that the practice of what we're discussing here today in an American-seated arbitration, in an arbitration seated in the United States, will be governed, if at all, by whatever institutional rules, if at all, the parties adopted. So rather than look to the law books, rather than look to the statutes, any arbitrator sitting in the United States will focus his or her attention on the institutional rules if it was an institutional arbitration, which the vast majority are. So we'll be looking at the LCIA, we'll be looking at the ICC rules, we'll look at the UNCITRAL rules, we'll look at the ICSID rules, whatever they may be. If we had an ad hoc arbitration, we would have neither a useful statute nor a useful set of rules unless the UNCITRAL rules had been adopted by the parties for purposes of that ad hoc arbitration. So that is a reality that needs to be put on the table. Now, therefore, since there's nothing distinctive about the availability of interim relief in American law, it is not, and since it draws its guidelines from arbitral practice, if I were to go on, and I won't much further, talk about the American law, I'd be talking about international arbitral practice. Arbitrators sitting in the United States do what arbitrators do. And that is, their normative source. Now, you've had enough speakers today to discuss the question of why interim relief, and I have nothing distinctive to add about that. I would underscore what was said by an earlier speaker, that security for costs is a perennial. It's a perennial form of interim relief in arbitration, I think throughout the world, but certainly in the United States. So that is a species, I would call it a species of interim relief that is very salient in international arbitration as opposed to interim relief in a national court where we would not find it as likely, although I wouldn't say it's ruled out. Now I want to turn then, still sticking with the arbitration, I want to turn to the factors, the criteria, the considerations. And again, everything has been said, I would simply emphasize something that was not emphasized this morning, but was emphasized after lunch by our speakers. In the practice of interim relief and international arbitration, at least in the United States, but I think elsewhere, a very, very, very big factor, very important factor, is not merely the urgency of the situation, but the irreparability of the harm that is sought. And I can simply tell you, based on my experience, but every other arbitrator in the room will have had this experience, if it can be demonstrated that the harm that is contemplated could be remedied after the fact by an award of damages, that will not necessarily, of course, exclude the availability of interim relief, but it would probably somewhat prejudice the availability of interim relief. So I think irreparability, as it is known, is a, I think, a distinctively present factor of consideration. The only single species of interim relief that I want to mention in particular has already been mentioned. That's what happens when you come this late in the program, is the anti-suit injunction. We don't come quite as close to the UK in our relish of anti-suit injunctions, but we are quite generous. Our courts are quite generous in affording anti-suit injunctions. And so, when an arbitration agreement is raised in a court as a basis for a dismissal, for a lack of jurisdiction, not only will the court stay the, well, if it upholds the arbitration agreement, not only will it stay the litigation, not only will it refer the parties to arbitration, which we sometimes misleadingly call compel arbitration, but it has become routine to issue an anti-suit injunction. Now, when I say routine, I don't mean to say it occurs in the majority of cases. I simply mean that anti-suit injunctions have become one of the means, among others, of enforcing agreements to arbitrate. And they may be coupled with a stay of the litigation at hand, an order referring the parties to arbitration, and for good measure, an anti-suit injunction which would address any court in the world for all practical purposes. I do want to mention here something that hasn't been mentioned, but I think it needs to be by any jurisdiction that takes anti-suit injunctions seriously, and that is the prospect, which I've actually experiencing in a case right now, of something of a war between an arbitral tribunal issuing an, well, I should say a court issuing an anti-arbitration injunction, which is happening, and the tribunal responding with an anti-suit injunction. Okay, now you've all heard about anti-suit injunctions and counter-anti-suit injunctions and counter-counter-anti-suit injunctions ad infinitum, but I am now beginning to observe this kind of contestation between courts and tribunals. And in one case in which I'm sitting right now, the arbitral tribunal was not enjoined, but the claimant was enjoined and told to cease arbitrating. The tribunal wondered about whether it had an interest in asserting its jurisdiction. And I will simply say that in this particular case, we capitulated because the enjoining court was the court of the seat of arbitration. And it's probably not advisable for the tribunal to disregard an anti-arbitration injunction issued by a court of the seat. We're a court of a third country.
It was in the U.S., was it?
It was in the U.S. It was in the U.S. In fact, it was in a region, a special region of the U.S. known as Texas. Okay. So there is some correlation there. It's the Wild West. So I wanted to mention that. Now, therefore, so far as volet un is concerned, I'm really simply saying to you, you know, arbitrators do what you do. You know, do what you do. Even the restatement, which has just been approved, will be of no use because the restatement is strictly limited to the role of courts in arbitration. It has nothing to say about how arbitrators conduct themselves. Okay. Now, so I want to turn to my second volet, which is something that has been discussed also here, which is the role of courts in the prospect of issuing relief of this kind in aid of arbitration. I mentioned at the outset a slight terminological remark. We are very conscious, we've become very conscious that the term interim, and I should have said this earlier, so forgive me, that the term interim is, of course, plays a very big role in arbitration in the form of an interim award. In order to avoid confusion or misunderstandings between interim measure and an interim award, certainly the restatement, but more generally, we are trying to avoid the term interim when it comes to measures of provisional relief. In fact, we're trying to avoid the word interim altogether. So an interim award is now a partial award, and an interim measure, well, it won't be called that. It will be called any one of the others that I mentioned. And in the restatement, we said, well, we'll call them provisional measures. So that's the restatement term. If it's an interim measure, it was ordered by a tribunal. If it's a provisional measure, it was ordered by a court. And the term interim is religiously avoided because of the potential misunderstandings associated with the term interim. Now, when it comes to provisional measures, and that's the term I'll now use in this second dossier, it is understudied. The role of courts is simply understudied. Some would say, if they like that term, under-theorized. I don't really like that term, but it's certainly understudied. And it's really interesting when you look at the model law. We have now, since 2006, we have the very, very detailed provisions on interim, interim measures. And when it comes to provisional measures, there is the same old single provision saying that the existence of an arbitration agreement does not foreclose the availability of a provisional measure from a court. That alone tells you the fact that we would reform the model law, expand at enormous length, in my judgment, on interim measures, and have nothing more to say than the model law had to say at the beginning about provisional measures. And that's a sign of the relative neglect, of the subject. So what I want to do in this section, and I'm aware of the fact that we're well over time, but, you know, I started when my session was to end, okay? So just for the record. Okay, so I want to just make a few remarks of a descriptive character, a few remarks of a strategic character, and a few remarks of what might be called a normative character. Now, descriptively, I'd like to tell you a study was undertaken as to how often parties go to court for interim measures in connection with an arbitral proceeding. It was a study based on one federal district court in the United States, only one, over a relatively discrete period. And to no one's surprise, and the numbers are less important than the pattern, is that there are the largest category of cases in which courts intervene in arbitration is to compel arbitration. And the second one is to enforce or not enforce awards. But then comes interim measures. They are more common than set-aside actions. That's just, I found that very, very interesting. So that's the sequence. Enforcing the arbitration agreement, enforcing the award, provisional relief, and then set aside. I don't know what we want to infer from that. We don't regulate that, the role of courts, in any particular way. That is to say, if a court is asked to issue a measure of that kind, it will use the federal rules of civil procedure, which are applicable across the board. Rule 64 governs attachment. Rule 65 governs injunctions. Just for the record, Rule 64 says federal courts may attach, order the attachment of assets under the circumstances under which a state court in the state in which the federal court happens to sit could order attachment. So it's completely derivative of state law. Federal courts have no autonomous attachment authority. Those of you who know American law at all will know this is not surprising. A lot of American federal, I should say international, procedural issues are governed by state law. It shocks people, but they need to know the recognition and enforcement of a foreign judgment is governed by state law. And therefore, in theory, the standards can be different from federal district court to federal district court, depending upon the state in which the federal court happens to sit. The same thing on choice of law. Federal courts apply the choice of law rules of the state in which they sit. We have no federal choice of law principles. So when I tell you that provisional relief in federal court when it comes to attachment is governed by state law, I'm not telling you anything very surprising. I hope you'll appreciate that. Rule 65 does have standards for injunctive relief, however. So the standards that are used are not peculiar to the arbitration context. They are not in the least. I do want to say that I found one case that I found very amusing. It said, well, while we ordinarily would take probability of success on the merits as a factor alongside urgency, irreparability, balance de préjudice, irreparability. While we ordinarily also take into account the probability of success on the merits, the court in effect said, we never know what an arbitral tribunal will do. Okay, they are sort of, what shall we call them, wild cards. And therefore, there's no point in asking what the probable result would be, because you never know what an arbitral tribunal will do. That's what a federal district court said about arbitration. Okay, that's, I find, very intriguing. So that's all I want to say from a descriptive matter. I want to turn to strategic considerations. I think these were alluded to, but I think it's important. If you're living in a world where parties have a choice, if they have a choice between a judicial and an arbitral forum for interim relief, I think it's important to sort of at least acknowledge what considerations they might take into account. Now, there's nothing very original here, but it's we think about this a lot. We're very pragmatic. We don't just think sort of abstractly about judicial relief and arbitral relief, but what works best? What works best? So we obviously have what was mentioned earlier, that an arbitral tribunal may not yet have been constituted. That may be a reason to go to court. The emergency arbitrator has arrived, okay, has arrived, and that may mitigate the relative advantage of going to a court. There still remains the advantage that a court has when the addressee of the measure is not before the arbitral tribunal, is not within the jurisdiction of the arbitral tribunal, and that remains an advantage. Although I should tell you that parties in arbitration and tribunals themselves have taken up the habit of going to a court where a third party is located, and therefore a court to which that third party is subject to get a subpoena to testify in aid of the arbitration. So we can indirectly bring a third party into the arbitration, either as a witness or a custodian of documents, or something of that kind. Now, going to a court has certain negatives, if you have a choice. What are those negatives? Some have said that it is a relative impairment of confidentiality, or could be, because the moment you're in court, things become transparent. If that's very important under the circumstances, then going to a court would have the disadvantage of prejudicing the confidentiality. A question that was raised a moment ago, the parties may have foregone, they may have relinquished the right to go to a court. That would be enforceable under American law. So that choice disappears. And then we are told by lawyers, I'm told, counsel, I'm a lawyer, told by counsel that they worry a little bit about the offense that a tribunal might take. The offense that a tribunal might take, if a party goes to court for relief that the tribunal is perfectly well situated to entertain and possibly to grant. So I wanted to put that strategic dimension on the table because I hadn't heard too much of that yet today. Now, normatively, it may come as a surprise to you to know, but American law 40 years ago forbade access to a court for interim relief in arbitration. In virtually every jurisdiction that had occasion to address the matter. In the leading cases, which came out of the state of New York, it was held that for a party to go to court for interim relief in aid of arbitration was two things. If it was a New York Convention case, it was a violation of Article 2 for the court to even entertain the application. Why? Because the court is supposed to refer the parties to arbitration. And therefore, it is a violation of the Federal Arbitration Act insofar as it implements the New York Convention. And some courts went so far as to say what the model law now prevents, which is that if you go to a court for interim relief, you impliedly waive your right to arbitrate. Okay, so what's interesting for me is that that position was justified 40 years ago as pro-arbitration. It was said to be pro-arbitration to disallow courts, to disallow them to intervene in the form of provisional relief. And I think everybody in the room today will agree with me that we're probably being more pro-arbitration by allowing courts to afford interim relief in an appropriate case, of course, and only in an appropriate case. So we've now gone 180 degrees. Okay? It is perfectly legitimate, and it's all a question of whether and how the court assesses, to borrow your term, how it exercises its discretion, but better yet, assesses the merits of granting that relief. And it is also so that the right to afford interim relief is not limited to the court of the seat. And I think you would probably agree in the laws you've been discussing that it isn't the seat that has a monopoly. It isn't the courts of the seat that have a monopoly over the matter. Now, one exception that hasn't been mentioned yet today, and that is ICSID. It's not that particularly well known, but the ICSID Convention actually forbids judicial interim, or I'll call it provisional relief, in the absence of party agreement that it should be available. That's understood to be in Rule 39. In fact, it is in Rule 39, derived, I'm told, from Article 26, which is the article of the convention that conveys more powerfully than any other article the self-contained character of ICSID. And Rule 39 is express and explicit that unless the parties have agreed, and I would assume expressly agreed, recourse to a court for interim relief is forbidden. And that's a corollary of the self-contained character of ICSID arbitration. So that's an important, I think, caveat when we are think about the role that courts may play in the affording of provisional relief. I want to, in closing on this little bit, I want to underscore something that may be obvious to you, but whether you're a court of the seat or you're not a court of the seat, no interim measure can be addressed to anybody who is not within the personal jurisdiction of that court. And that calls into play a very, very rich and complicated jurisprudence on the personal jurisdiction of American courts, which we will certainly not venture into here. A couple of very interesting questions have arisen in our courts recently pertaining to this relationship. We have too few cases to know where we stand. Too few cases. But there is apparently a division in the courts over the extent to which access to a court, a national court, should continue unabated. Availability should be unabated throughout the life of the arbitration, or whether it tapers off as the arbitration proceeds, kind of a sliding scale, so that we go from one extreme, we have no tribunal, and let us say we have no emergency arbitrator, and then, of course, the court is where the game is played, and nowhere else. But as the arbitration proceeds, some courts have actually expressly stated that we will be more restrained than we would be under other circumstances. That, in a way, provisional relief is subsidiary. It is subsidiary to arbitral relief. And that subsidiarity grows as the arbitration proceeds. We even have a couple of cases, and they disagree on what should be done when there is an emergency arbitrator. Unsurprisingly, we have a case that says if there's an emergency arbitrator, we have no role to play. I mean, you opted for an emergency arbitrator. We're off. We're off the hook. Don't come to us. I don't know whether that would apply to the situation in which you hadn't appointed an emergency arbitrator but had the option of doing so, and whether the mere option of doing so would foreclose. But that simply remains to be seen. Now, the last thing I want to say on this point before I get to my last and very brief volé is when we look at the decisions on the factors to be considered, I told you we have all the usual factors that you all know and love. And we have them all. But there's one that is surfacing with ever greater prominence and which I actually applaud. And it hasn't been mentioned. I think it may be somewhat peculiar to American law, but it is how receptive is the tribunal to the intervention of the court? Receptivity. Sometimes termed amenability. How amenable is the tribunal to this intervention by a court in the middle of its proceedings? Now, you may say that's very inventive on the Americans' part. They come up with something nobody had come up with, I think. I could be wrong about that. You can tell me if you're doing that. But this amenability, receptivity thinking is derived from another whole matter, which is not on the table today, but could have been because it's closely related, and that is access to a court for discovery in aid of arbitration. That's not our subject, unless you want to call a discovery order a measure of judicial relief of some kind, which I guess you could. But our case law on the availability of access to an American court for obtaining evidence for use in the arbitration has been driven by receptivity and amenability considerations. How does the tribunal feel about whether access to American-style discovery would contaminate, okay, would contaminate the proceedings that the tribunal is directing. And our courts in that domain are actually asking themselves, the question is, how do they really know what the tribunal thinks will be the impact on the integrity of the arbitral process if courts intervene? And that raises a question we have no time to go into, which is, what kind of dialogue should there be between courts and tribunals when it comes to activities in which both can engage and in which you might say they're in competition or potential competition? And I don't know enough to know, but I welcome any news there might be in the room about the extent to which tribunals converse with courts on matters of any kind, but certainly a matter of this kind or on discovery, for that matter. I think it would not be unhealthy if it were to take place, but it certainly is not, there's no mechanism of which I'm aware. So I wanted to close that dossier on that question. Now, the third and final, and very brief, is the question of judicial enforcement of arbitral measures, interim measures. And here, the American view is very well established. No matter how non-final an interim measure may appear to be, it is final for purposes of enforceability. It's a position that may not sound particularly logical, but I think we've taken the position that I heard earlier today, or I read earlier today, that, well, it's a final disposition of the request. It's a final disposition of the request. It may not be a final disposition of the merits, but it is a final disposition of the request at that point in time, and so it's final. And so we have a presumption, a powerful presumption in American law, that measures of interim relief ordered by arbitrators are awards. Counterintuitive though that may seem, that presumption is carried over in the restatement. And I won't go into, because I don't have the time, what it would take to rebut that particular presumption. I'll close with the observation that if we do treat interim measures as awards and we enable them to be enforced judicially, does that imply they may be vacated? And I will simply say the model law does provide that they are enforceable. It doesn't say anything about whether they are vacatable. And you might think they're two sides of the same coin, and if they're enforceable, they should also be vacatable. I think that's probably right. Lastly, if you're going to make interim measures enforceable as if awards, then you need, as we've come to be, very mindful of the distinction between an interim measure and a procedural order. Okay, because while they may seem like distinct categories, they may not be quite distinct. And in theory, a procedural order is not an award, and it will have a hard time becoming an award. An interim measure is an award. We have a couple of hybrids, like an order to preserve evidence will be issued in the form of a procedural order, very, very possibly, and therefore viewed as a procedural order. But if it's viewed as a measure of interim relief, then it is enforceable and possibly vacatable. So on that note, I want to conclude that there's something maverick about American law, generally speaking, and there's certainly something maverick about the American law of this particular subject, but it is a subject that's alive and well and getting lots of attention. Thank you.